Thank you for a fun introduction.
It's very bittersweet for me to be back at UCLA. I graduated 1973. I was here for 4 years from 1969. I always wear, and I still wear today, my class ring from UCLA. I had interned for the Los Angeles Police Department. I was in the political science or public service curriculum of the poli-sci department. And I interned at LAPD. I was chosen to intern for Chief Ed Davis of LAPD. At the same time, my closest friend on campus, Craig Fuller, was chosen to intern for Governor Ronald Reagan. From 69 to 73, we were the only two living Republicans on campus. Of course, I've gone through many changes since then, but one day in particular that I will never, ever forget was the day of May 5th, 1970. And what happened on May 5th, 1970 was that a group of students at Kent State were shot dead by National Guardsmen after the U.S. invasion of Cambodia. Now, I was a sophomore then, I had seen tear gas on campus, and of course it was a daily or weekly occurrence to occupy the admin building and everything else. The Vietnam War was a raging, but I parked, I don't know if they still have Lot 32. It used to be down near Veteran. You had to take a bus from there to get up here. And every day when I came to school for 4 years, there were 1, 2, 3, 4 new funerals in progress, and almost all of those tombstones you see in the Veterans Cemetery are from the Vietnam War. And on the day of May 5th, when the shootings at Kent State happened, of course, this entire campus exploded, absolutely exploded. And now here I am 31 years later and saying my generation didn't do a very good job of finding answers. I don't know what happened, but I would much rather be here under some other circumstance than facing a draft again, than the world running out of hydrocarbon energy, than us being in the middle of a sequential war to control the last remaining oil reserves on the planet, on the dawn of a new age of upheaval. But here I am at UCLA, and it's an honor. It truly is an honor. And so I've written this book called Crossing the Rubicon. And for those of you who don't know, for history majors, you will know, you should, that in 49 BC, Julius Caesar took a Roman legion and crossed the boundary of Rome. And under the laws of the Roman Republic, it was forbidden to take a legion or the army into Rome. And he crossed the Rubicon River, which was the boundary. It's actually a little creek, in 49 BC, which marked the beginning of the civil wars, the death of the Roman Republic, and the birth of the Roman Empire. Rubicon, for me, also metaphorically or in a literary sense, means crossing a point of no return. Once you cross this line, things can never go back to being the way they were again. So what did I do in this book? Why did I write this book? Well, first of all, I wrote this book because I've been saying, most of you know, for 26 years, what happened was the CIA tried to recruit me twice. First time I was a senior here, spring break of 73, I was flown back to Washington, D.C. And a CIA case officer in the old executive office building said, Mike, you got a perfect background, you're in great shape, you're handsome, you're white, you're Republican, blah, blah, blah. We want to make you a CIA case officer, and then we'll put you back through the LAPD Academy, and that will be your cover. That was illegal then. It is not illegal since the Patriot Act. I turned that down, didn't want to do that. Then I started working South Central Los Angeles, met a very beautiful, sexy, wonderful woman at my bar who was a career contract agent for the CIA. That recruitment was a little different from the first one. I wound up turning that down because even though we had become engaged and were living together, what I saw was that she was involved in bringing large amounts of drugs into the United States, and I wouldn't cross that line. That ended my LAPD career in 1978, and I've been on the record publicly about that ever since. So when 9/11 happened, I was already skeptical. I'd been publishing my newsletter From the Wilderness since March of 1998. I had about, 1,200 subscribers on 9/11. Now we have just passed 20,000 subscribers in more than 40 countries around the world, including professors at more than 48 universities in 16 countries. So I'm incredibly grateful for that. And But I've been around the block a great many times, and most of it was being drugged behind a pickup truck on my face. So I've learned some lessons about how to fight and how not to fight. I look for what works. And I say it very clearly in this book. There's only one thing that matters to me, only one thing in the world. It is not money, although I do enjoy paying bills, finally. And my agent publicist is back there, and he'd kill me if I say I don't like money. But that's how we grow. I kept a promise I made at Portland State University in November of 2001. I don't know how many people have seen my video, Truth and Lies of 9/11. How many have seen that? Filmed it at Portland State University in November of 2001. And the promise that I made then was that you buy my stuff, and I will keep hiring more writers. And I will keep bringing you more stories. And since that time, I had one writer in November of 2001. Today I support three editors, four to five freelance writers, a full-time office staff of seven, and I have kept that promise. And if you've seen some of my writers, we have some of the best. We have Stan Goff, retired U.S. Army Special Forces Master Sergeant who taught at West Point, Dale Allen Pfeiffer, a geologist who is our energy editor, Michael Caine in New York, this wonderful, energetic, up-and-coming charger investigative journalist who gets into the faces of the commanding generals of NORAD. So we've kept that promise because that's how we make each other stronger. And when I decided to approach 9/11, I knew that 9/11 was a crime. When I saw the second plane hit the World Trade Center, my father was in the Air Force. He had flown in interceptors. I knew enough about Air Force procedures to know that that second plane alone said something was wrong about 9/11. But I have maintained a solid approach that I would write nothing about September the 11th unless it was legally admissible in a court of law. I was trained as a police officer. I worked detectives with LAPD. I worked narcotics with LAPD. As a journalist, before I started my newsletter, I'd freelance for the LA Times, the Daily News, a bunch of other publications. So I had a set of standards for the presentation of evidence, and I've adhered to those strictly. And what I have produced in this book, Crossing the Rubicon, is a legal case that as a detective, or were I a deputy assistant district attorney, and I'm not a lawyer, but I've been around enough lawyers, and I know how I've been through enough trials, I know what you have to do. I would be proud to take this case to a grand jury or to a jury and indict the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, the Attorney General, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Commanding General of NORAD, and a whole bunch of other people on charges of premeditated murder. And if there's any lawyers out there, I know that Ken and I are planning on talking to a number of very influential legal groups, and we're going to ask them to take the book that way and look at it and say, is it a case or not? I can tell you that today a copy of the book was handed to the New York State Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, who is considering opening a criminal investigation of 9/11. And you probably heard the Zogby poll says that about 50% of the people in New York already believe that the government was criminally involved somehow in 9/11. So the New York Attorney General has a copy as of today, and we hope to get more of these copies out. So now I want to start quickly and talk about some of the things that we've got in here. And now here I'm going to talk a bit about premeditation. Some of these things, when I was with LAPD, we would call them clues. Notice the plans to seize Iraqi oil were in place since 1995. My dear friend, Professor Michelle Chalcedovsky, who teaches economics at the University of Ottawa, is a brilliant writer, very good friend, dug up some plans directly from the Pentagon showing that they had the contingency plans drawn in 1995 to seize Iraqi oil. One of my favorite clues comes from a book written by Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter. He was an intelligence consultant to both Presidents Reagan and Bush I, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, very, very good friends with David Rockefeller. In 1997, he wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard. And in this book, he talked about the imperative. He loves to use those words, geostrategic imperatives, for the United States to control the Eurasian continent. One of the reasons why was because it contained about 70% of the world's known energy resources. And in that 1997 book, he placed a map of where the next world conflict was going to break out. That's within the dotted line. The zone of pressure, he said, was in the solid black line, but he said within that dotted line there, that's where the next war is going to be. Now that, in LAPD terms, is a clue. Somebody knew this was coming. In that book, in three separate places, he makes reference vaguely and sometimes really not so vaguely to the fact that an attack on the order of Pearl Harbor would be necessary to mobilize the American people to support, his term, the imperial mobilization. He also said that the American people would not support the military moves unless there was a direct external threat. Very, very clear. This was also discussed in a report by the Project for a New American Century, which apparently is not here in my short presentation, but that's okay. So we have a clear record of the fact that these kinds of attacks, the PNAC, as it's called, Project for a New American Century, released a report in 2000, which made a specific reference to a Pearl Harbor-like attack. Now we come a little bit further. Now, so we have some premeditation, but we're still now laying motive. The fact is, and I will discuss more about this later on in the presentation, that the world is beginning to run out of hydrocarbon energy, oil and natural gas. And what is clear and what I'm going to show you now is the fact that Dick Cheney knew it, the fact that the administration knew it, and the fact that it was a hot topic, so to speak, long before 9/11, but also in the months leading right up to 9/11. In a story we broke on our website, From the Wilderness, by the way, the website is www.fromthewilderness.com. Feel free to go. About 80% of the stories are free. And you can find there's lots of archives there and lots of documents there. We showed, and as far as I'm concerned, the deepest, darkest secrets of September the 11th are concealed, hidden in the records of the National Energy Policy Development Group, which is Vice President Cheney's, was Vice President Cheney's, Energy Task Force, which convened just days after the administration was sworn in. And it concluded its work in May of 2001, just a few short months before the attack. And it has refused to release its records to the public in direct violation of the Constitution because they were consulting not just within government, but they were inviting private corporations in on the taxpayer dollar. Legally, we have a right to know when the government does that. Congressman Henry Waxman of California fought a huge battle over that. The GAO did. They finally caved. But there were two lawsuits, one from the Sierra Club and one from a conservative group called the Judicial Watch in Washington, D.C., which did force the release of 7 pages of records from the group. Many of the pages had to do with Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and the United Arab Emirates. And what they were lists of all the oil fields in those countries. They were lists of every country and every company within those countries and what kind of percentage investment they had within the oil fields of those, and there were maps. Now, the map that you're looking at on the screen right now is a composite map that I made from piecing together, if you will, a cut and paste of the maps that came out of NEPDG. And what you see are all the oil fields that were being discussed. But now let me shock you a little bit. What you are looking at right there in that triangle on the left is 60% of all the recoverable oil on planet Earth. 60% of all the oil, known oil, recoverable on planet Earth. And if you look on the right, when that map is in, when that triangle is inserted into the state of Texas, you see how small that area really is. We'll come to a map in a minute, which will be another piece of very strong circumstantial evidence. But now let me read you a little quote from NEPDG. This is from Cheney's final report. America, in the year 2001, faces the most serious energy shortage since the oil embargoes of the 1970s. Estimates indicate that over the next 20 years, U.S. oil consumption will increase by 33%, natural gas consumption by well over 50%, and demand for electricity will rise by 45%. U.S. energy consumption is expected to increase by about 32% by 2020. Between 2000 and 2020, U.S. natural gas demand is projected by the EIA to increase by more than 50%. Yet we produce 39% less oil today than we did in 1970. 1970 is relevant because that was the peak of United States oil production. We have been in steady decline in this country in oil production ever since 1970, leaving us ever more reliant on foreign suppliers. On our present course, America 20 years from now will import nearly 2 of every 3 barrels of oil. a condition of increased dependency on foreign powers, quote, that do not always have America's interests at heart. I love how Cheney phrases things. Does the rest of the world have an obligation to have our interests at heart? I ask rhetorically. Here's a quote from a neighboring institution, California Institute of Technology. The Vice Chancellor, David Goodstein, wrote a really good book called Out of Gas. And he writes, he argues forcefully that the worldwide production of oil will peak soon, possibly within this decade. I personally believe that planet Earth is at peak oil plus or minus 1 year right now. That will be followed by declining availability of fossil fuels that could plunge the world into global conflicts as nations struggle to capture their piece of a shrinking pie. Yes. Statement by the president. Now we come, so, okay, we know basically, and believe me, it's much more detail in the book Crossing the Rubicon. If you haven't seen it, it's 700 pages with 1,000 footnotes. Go check them all. Prove me wrong, please. Somebody, okay? We have an idea of what the motive is. I've kind of laid it out briefly. We'll come back to it more later. But now we go to means, motive, and opportunity. The opportunity and premeditation come together as we see that before 9/11, a number of changes were made in the way the United States government operated. A very key one of these was this particular statement released by the White House on May 8, 2001, almost at exactly the time that NEPDG released its final report. And basically, to paraphrase this, the entire text of it is in the book. President Bush suddenly placed Vice President Cheney to oversee the complete development of a coordinated national effort to do the very best possible job of protecting our people from harm. And he asked Joe Albaugh, the director of FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, to create an Office of National Preparedness. And Dick Cheney was placed in charge of all training and preparation for attacks using weapons of mass destruction. But if you read it logically, legally, you very clearly make the case it's for any terror attacks, including aircraft used as weapons. Cheney's position was not only superordinate, it was supreme. Cheney had operational control as a result of a statement in here where Cheney was charged with overseeing to ensure their planning, training, and equipment needs are addressed and to play the lead role in crisis management. So Dick Cheney now is placed in charge of all planning for terrorist attacks above every other agency in the federal government. On the day of September the 11th, and there are many, 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 many things that were going on September 11th that are anomalous, that stand out as being inconsistent and wrong. But the hook, what I will be using on soundbites, and what day is today? Thursday? On Sunday, I will be in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, taping with NBC a segment where I get to use the soundbites. And this is the soundbite. This is the hook that starts to pull 9/11 off. Apart and the government apart. And that's that on the morning of September the 11th, as the attacks were beginning, four separate war game exercises involving the U.S. Air Force, three or possibly four, were underway simultaneously. Vigilant Guardian reported in multiple press sources, including Aviation News and Newhouse News, a bunch of other papers. Vigilant Warrior, cited by Richard Clark, former counter-terror czar, in his book, quoting acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers. Northern Guardian, Toronto Star, December 9th. Northern Vigilance, Toronto Star, December 9th. Northern Guardian may or may not have been underway. It was named once, never discussed. But we can just run with those three and pull it all into place. And coincidentally, an unnamed plane into building exercise at the National Reconnaissance Office. Now, if you know anything about the government, the NRO operates all the spy satellites. It's run by the CIA and the Air Force. Right outside of Dulles Airport, they were just happened to have this drill going underway with the fire trucks about a plane crashing into their building on the morning of 9/11. Two distinctions I want to make. I'm going to teach you some mil-speak here. FTX, field training exercise, involves simulation. That's where you have guys running around with guns, you have planes flying in the air playing games. CPX, or command post exercise, is strictly something that takes place in the command post not involving a field exercise, but it can involve inserting radar blips onto radar screens, which happened on 9/11. It can involve traffic about planes being hijacked. But FTX is critical to understand that that's a live-fly, real-world scenario that's being acted out. And that distinction will become very critical here in just a second. One other change that was made that I took out because I had to shorten this up tonight was also in June of 2001, NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense Command, had been charged with protecting American airspace. Now, how many people remember the Payne Stewart crash of 1999? Very briefly, Payne Stewart had a chartered Learjet taking off from Florida, flying to Dallas. They had explosive decompression at altitude. Everybody died. The reason why they had that was because they had a chest of dry ice on board, and they didn't tell the pilot. Dry ice will do that in a pressurized cabin at altitude. It is standard procedure and has been for decades that any aircraft under instrument flight rules, whether it's commercial or general aviation, if it misses a turn, if it doesn't respond to a radio communication, or if it fails to squawk a transponder code, and that's just a little frequency you dial. The air traffic controller will say, United 175 heavy, turn left bearing 342, squawk 2480. And he'll turn a dial to frequency 2480, whatever the cycles are, and push a button, and that lights him up on the radar screen. It's been standard procedure for a long, long time that if any one of those things doesn't happen, and there is no response from the aircraft, fighter aircraft are automatically scrambled. We know from the Associated Press prior to June 1 of 2001, NORAD aircraft scrambled 67 times and were flying beside off-course aircraft within minutes in just 1 year. Associated Press said that. I didn't make it up. Routine. What happened now was you had a little change in June when the standard NORAD protocols were overwritten and only Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld could authorize the scrambling of aircraft. There were some exclusions in there which allowed Air Force commanders, base commanders, or commanders from different commands to act on their own. That's exactly what happened. You see a quote from General Arnold, three-star Air Force general on 9/11, who did what any Air Force pilot would do. My dad flew in interceptors. We were stationed in Maine during the Korean War. I still remember how cold it was. And his task then was to hop in his F-89 Scorpion. He was the guy in back, the radar operator and the weapons operator, and go shoot down Russians coming over the pole. But I can tell you, any Air Force pilot, if they knew that this country was under attack, they wouldn't wait for orders. They'd go up and shoot the turkeys down. And there was no guarantee. And so General Arnold, you see him on the day of September 11th saying, I told him to scramble. We'll get the clearances later. So now I'm laying a scenario where hopefully you should be asking, well, how did they get around all of this stuff? How did they keep people? I'm going to explain it to you right now. We find the answer to this by looking at the war games. Vigilant Guardian, deception number one. They confuse the name with other exercises. Now, this is from NewJersey.com, as they quoted from Air Force sources. NORAD has also confirmed it was running two mock drills on 9/11 at various radar sites and command centers in the U.S. and Canada, including Air Force bases in upstate New York, Florida, Washington, and Alaska. Gee. One drill, Operation Vigilant Guardian, began a week before 9/11 and reflected a Cold War mindset. Participants practiced for an attack across the North Pole by Russian forces. That is an absolute lie. Vigilant Guardian was a hijack drill. Well, I'm going to prove that to you here in just a second. This is from the NORAD website. Now, as one of the things that I have done with my 9/11 research is I am known that I do original investigative work. I go out and I question people. I knock on their doors and answer. Now, most of the time, I would like to ask questions like Andy Sipowicz of NYPD Blue. But because I don't have a badge and a gun and I can't throw anybody around or lock them in a cage, I have to more often approach my questioning like Lieutenant Columbo. You know, you got this and you got that and you got this and I got, I don't want to get this. Please help me. And that's exactly, it works. So as I started questioning NORAD, I was forwarded a response by Major Maria Kwan of NORAD headquarters in Colorado. Northern Vigilance redeploys fighters. The North American Aerospace Defense Command shall deploy fighter aircraft as necessary to forward operating locations in Alaska and northern Canada to monitor a Russian Air Force exercise in the Russian Arctic and North Pacific Ocean. Emphasis added. This is from the NORAD website, which was talking about Northern Vigilant, not Vigilant Guardian. Remember, they were trying to confuse you about what Vigilant Guardian was. This is from the NORAD website. So somebody's lying to somebody here. And, of course, as a detective, that's what you try to do. You try to get people to lie. I have this anecdote that I tell in the book. In 1977, I was back out of detectives, working uniform, training officer, and I had a probationer. And the guys from Administrative Narcotics served a search warrant down in South Central Los Angeles, a place called the Jungle, where I worked. And we crashed an apartment where they had 6 kilos of Mexican brown heroin and 3 suspects. And so we got in, got the heroin. 3 suspects gave us 4 different stories of how the 6 kilos got there. By the time we got to 10 different explanations of how the 6 kilos got there, we got signed confessions. That's the way it works. And that's essentially the approach I have taken on 9/11 with the U.S. government. Northern Vigilance now, if we study the literature for Northern Vigilance, and I do owe a great debt to investigative journalist Barbara Honegger, who kept telling me and insisting that I had to go back and look at the war games. I had to go back and look at the war games. She didn't have it all put together, but boy, she was right. They turned out to be the holy grail of 9/11. Now, if you look at the bolded parts here, this is from the Toronto Star of December 9, 2001. Northern Vigilance planned months in advance, blah, blah. Part of the exercise is pure simulation, but part is real world. NORAD is keeping a close eye on the Russians. We're getting confused. That's Northern Vigilance. Okay. The FAA has evidence of a hijacking and is asking for NORAD support. This is, quote, not part of the exercise. So we know already now we see that there was confusion. Was it exercise or real world? In a flash, Northern Vigilance is called off. Any simulated information, what's known as an inject, is purged from the screens. False radar blips on FAA and NORAD radar screens on September the 11th? Did you ever hear anything about that? Anybody told you about that? Well, if it was just coming over the Russian pole, why would it have any relevance to the Northeast Air Defense Sector, which is from Washington up to Massachusetts and Maine? So therefore, the injects very likely were on the Northeast Air Defense Sector's radar screens. We're going to see more about that in a second. Now, Canadian General Rick Findlay, who was at NORAD, he says, I'm not too sure if they're that clever to coordinate that kind of attack. If they're that clever to coordinate that kind of attack, what else is taking place? I'm going to tell you what else is taking place. Remember all the stories about Condoleezza Rice saying, we had no idea that anybody would use airplanes as weapons. Do you remember her saying that? Everybody who believes her, raise your hand. Kenny, you got to find me a cough drop. I'm dying up here. NORAD had, there were all kinds of exercises prior to 9/11 where they had drilled for jets crashing into buildings. This is from CNN. Sometime between 91 and 2001, NORAD simulated a foreign hijacked airliner crashing into a building in the U.S. as part of a training exercise. Go down to the bold. Look at this. The sector exercise involves some flying of military aircraft as well as a command post exercise. So now we got an FTX and a CPX in which communications procedures were practiced in an office environment. According to a statement from NORAD, before 9/11, NORAD regularly conducted a variety of exercises that included hijack scenarios. These exercises tested track detection and identification, scramble and interception, hijack procedures. Scramble and interception. Here's a clue. In the Air Force, you don't have a drill where a guy flies up in an F-16 and hijacks thin air. Doesn't work. Air Force has been flying these things for a long, long time. My dad flew them. I used to watch the films of it. You have a remotely piloted vehicle, in most cases, or a real live fly vehicle, posing as the hijacked airliner. Why? Because if you're an Air Force pilot, you can't go up, fly above, rock your wings, move behind, do missile lock if the plane tries to fly away. That's what these guys train for. So they have to have aircraft posing as hijacked airliners. So we know that had been done. Vigilant Guardian was a hijack drill, not a Cold War exercise. The first thing, This is a quote that went through my mind after receiving the alert for Flight 11 was, is this part of the exercise? Some kind of screw-up. That's ABC News quoting, I believe, General Arnold. Tech Sergeant Jeremy Powell of the Northeast Air Defense Sector took the first call from Boston. He notified NEADS Commander, that's the Northeast Air Defense Sector, Commander Colonel Robert Marr of a possible hijacked airliner. Quote, part of the exercise, the colonel wondered. No, this is real world, he was told several days into a semi-annual exercise known as Vigilant Guardian. Lieutenant Colonel Don Deskins, his second in command, figured it was going to be a long day. It was day two of Vigilant Guardian, an exercise that would pose an imaginary crisis to North American air defense outposts nationwide. It must be part of the exercise, Deskins thought. So now we know that these exercises are taking place and they're having a direct impact on the Northeast air defense sector, and it's even confusing the FAA. False radar injects and lie-fly hijack drills. Vigilant Warrior, I love this. How many people have read Richard Clark's book, Against All Enemies? One of my subscribers and a great activist up in San Francisco, Carol Brule, just confronted Richard Clark with my book. And he ran out and saying, I don't think I care to answer any more questions from you conspiracy theorists. And all she was doing was reading him quotes from his own book. I love it. Quoting Richard Clark, FAA Administrator Jane, where's Norm? This is Clark talking, I asked. They were frantically looking for Norman Mineta, the Secretary of Transportation, and like me, a rare holdover from the Clinton administration. At first, the FAA could not find Mineta. Well, Jane, can you order aircraft down? We're going to have to clear the airspace around Washington and New York. We may have to do a lot more than that, Dick. I already put a hold on all takeoffs and landings in New York and Washington. This is Jane Garvey. But we have reports of 11 aircraft off course or out of communications, maybe hijacked. I produce another document in the book that showed when the hijackings began, the FAA had as many as 22 possible hijackings in progress. Now, what had happened, and we establish in the book clearly, is that when they were setting up Northern Vigilance, they moved a whole bunch. It's top secret. How many? They wouldn't tell me. Nor classified, can't tell you. They wouldn't tell me how many fighters they had pulled out of the continental U.S. in the Northeast Air Defense Sector and sent them up to Alaska and Canada. So now you've taken the fighters away. There were only eight scramble-ready fighters in the Northeast Air Defense Sector. If you know anything about fighters, when they scramble to intercept, they fly with a wingman. So you can only intercept four possible hijackings out of 22. Now what do you do if you're the Air Force? You cannot even think about sending them until you know, because you might be sending them in the wrong direction and you've taken them out of play. Jane Garvey just confirmed 11. So 4 out of 11, that left 7. Your odds are not very good that if you just start scrambling. They didn't know where to send the fighters. It gets better. Clark says, I turned to the radar screen, JCS, JCS, that's Joint Chiefs of Staff. I assume NORAD has scrambled fighters and AWACS. How many? Where? Quote, not a pretty picture, Dick. Dick Myers, that's General Richard Myers, himself a fighter pilot, knew that the days when we had scores of fighters on strip alert had ended with the Cold War. Quote, we are in the middle of Vigilant Warrior, a NORAD exercise. Vigilant Warrior. Not Vigilant Guardian, not Northern Vigilance, but Vigilant Warrior. Okay. But Otis has launched two birds, blah, 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 blah. It was now 9:29. Okay, so now I'm thinking, where are all these exercises? And what idiot scheduled all these exercises to happen on the morning of 9/11? Somebody's got to be responsible for that, right? Of course, the idiot was Dick Cheney. We'll get there. I'm just so confused. Columbo, right? Long, all the evidence laid out, I started barraging people. Confirmation that Vigilant Warrior was a live-fly hijack drill. Okay, so I started out on this quest. I sent emails. I made phone calls. I called NORAD. I sent them emails. I called the Pentagon. I sent them emails. I called the Department of the Air Force. I sent them emails. I called everybody. I sent them emails. I called Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida, which is the headquarters of 1st Air Force, which is the operational arm for NORAD response. I laid out all the evidence that I had on these war games, which tipped, of course, that I knew I was onto something. Well, everybody didn't know nothing. To put it in street talk, top secret, don't know, you have to go here, you have to go there. One guy helped out. His name was Major Don Arias. Don Arias has a very interesting story. I finally got an email back from him. I started sending out the emails in roughly, I think it was the last week in March. Finally on May 14th. I'm going to press. This is an emergency. This is a deadline. You got somebody. And he gets back to me. He says, okay, Mike, I looked this stuff up for you. Now, of course, when I do this, I don't hesitate to share my family background with the people I'm talking to because it makes them open up. Understand that I know a little bit something about how the Air Force works. So he writes back and said, NORAD Instruction 33-7. I was trying to straighten out the names first. Nicknames, a combination of two separate unclassified words, which is assigned an unclassified meaning. A nickname is used exclusively to designate a drill or exercise. Exercise terms are used to prevent confusion between exercise directives and with actual operations. Vigilant or amalgam means that it is a headquarters NORAD-sponsored exercise. Guardian means it is a multi-command CPX command post exercise or with no live fly. He wrote that. I'm quoting his email. The whole email is in the book, every word of it. So on 9/11, NORAD was conducting a NORAD-wide multi-command command post exercise with no live fly. But then he threw in, other exercise terms include warrior. Remember Richard Clark's book with Dick Myers? Warrior equals Joint Chiefs of Staff, Headquarters NORAD sponsored FTX or Field Training Exercise Live Fly. Written confirmation from United States Air Force officer that on the day of 9/11, the Joint Chiefs of Staff was conducting a live fly hijack drill with planes posing as hijacked airliners. Have you heard anything about that? No. Now, there's a reason why Don Arias, I think, let me know about this. He's a very forthcoming guy. He was actually working at Tyndall on the morning of 9/11 when everything went to hell. I found some other stories about what Don Arias did that day. And during the period after the hijacking of when Flight 11 had already crashed into the World Trade Center, there was about a 25-minute gap before Flight 175 became the second airliner to attack. But the Air Force, clearly I demonstrate and document in the book using official records, had known that 175 was hijacked for about a half an hour and headed toward Manhattan. Now, if you're thinking logically, you've had one hijacked airliner crash into one tower of the World Trade Center. You have a second airliner that's been hijacked and it's just turned to be headed toward Manhattan. Would it not be logical to assume that the second tower is the target? What did Don Arias do on that day? He left his post in the middle of the attacks, walked over to a telephone because his brother worked in the World Trade Center. And he called his brother in the World Trade Center and said, "You get out of that building." Now, don't you think it's kind of strange that nobody in NORAD, the Pentagon, the White House, the FAA, the Secret Service, I proved in the book that they all knew that Flight 175 was hijacked. Why didn't anybody issue a warning for the South Tower of the World Trade Center? You know what happened? They told everybody to go back to work. An Air Force major had to leave to pick up a landline to call his brother while everybody else in the World Trade Center was doomed to die. More spilled beans. April 18th, USA Today wrote, NORAD had drills of jets as weapons. It offered never-before-reported details of 9/11. Look at the bold. This is about drills, including live fly. One of the imagined targets was the World Trade Center. In another exercise, jets performed a mock shoot-down over the Atlantic Ocean of a jet supposedly laden with chemical poisons headed toward a target in the United States. In a third scenario, the target was the Pentagon. But that drill was not run after defense officials said it was unrealistic. NORAD and defense officials say, we have another story that says something else. This is also from USA Today. Numerous types of civilian and military aircraft were used as mock hijacked aircraft, the statement said. These exercises tested track detection and identification, scramble interception. We did that. Listen to this. A White House spokesman said Sunday that the Bush administration was unaware of the exercises. We're going to prove that to be a lie in a second. But the exercises using real aircraft show that at least one part of the government thought the possibility of the tax merited scrutiny. Until 9/11, NORAD was expected, that's absolute BS what they say next. NORAD was expected to defend the U.S. and Canada from aircraft based elsewhere. Which begs the question, well, who was supposed to defend the United States from aircraft hijacked inside? The LAPD? FBI? Civil Air Patrol? Who? NORAD had a clear record of having done that for many, many years, and I have files of operational plans going back to the 60s. But there were expectations in early drills, including one operation planned in July and conducted later, that involved planes from airports in Utah and Washington state that were hijacked. Those planes were escorted by U.S. Wait a minute, they actually ran the drills with hijacked airliners in the U.S. The King Commission tells you nothing about any of this, the so-called Independent Commission on 9/11. Another statement here, the NORAD statement, said one of the things that was being tested were the rules of engagement with the appropriate coordination between NORAD's command headquarters, its subordinate regions and sectors, and the national command authorities in Canada and the United States. Lawyers here, national command authority, what is the national command authority? The president. In his absence, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So if these drills involved working with the national command authority, how could the Bush White House say that they had no knowledge of these drills when they were part of it? See, this is the stuff you love to get people on the stand and start asking them questions about. This is where I'd love to be Sipowitz having these guys locked up in the room, you know. If we look at the final Kane Commission report released in June of this year, what the Kane Commission did was even more creative than what was done, I think, with the Warren Commission report. They just came up with a whole new set of numbers that nobody had ever offered them. The original NORAD timelines from press stories and from NORAD itself is the center column. When the report was released, the entire right-hand column is now what the Kane Commission said was the actual times that everything happened. Now, I've been through hundreds of press stories and accounts, Associated Press, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, the official NORAD statements. Not one of these times was mentioned in any of those. So in a criminal trial, what this is tantamount to you have the prosecution giving its version of events, you have the defense giving its version of events, the judge saying, I'm going to take a recess, I'm going into chambers, and the judge coming out with a whole new set of evidence that's never been introduced into evidence by either side. That's what the Kane Commission did. Because a lot of activists were on this. And believe me, Crossing the Rubicon, for those of you who have read the book, you know that it is 25 or 30 of the most incredible researchers and activists on the planet made this book happen, and I praise them throughout the book. I wrote it and did my own, but that book would not exist today had it not been for some incredible work by a lot of people who were digging. Many of them were at every 9/11 Commission hearing and in the faces of every witness there. And so they had to start changing things. We were doing the Colombo thing. We were doing the 6 kilos of Mexican brown, you said this, you said this. And we resorted to that kind of investigation to get these kind of admissions. So what did the Keene Commission report finally say about the war games? The only mention of any war games in the 9/11 Independent Commission report was in a footnote. Footnote number 116. Not even in the body of the text. On 9/11, NORAD was scheduled to conduct a military exercise, Vigilant Guardian, which postulated a bomber attack from the former Soviet Union. Wait a minute, they're lying about what the exercise was again. Northern Vigilance was the Soviet FSU exercise. We investigated whether military preparations for the large-scale exercise compromised the military's response to the real-world terrorist attack on 9/11. According to General Eberhardt, he was the commander of NORAD, it took about 30 seconds to make the adjustment to the real-world situation. That's from his testimony on June 17. All right, so clearly we have a problem in the Kane Commission. By the way, it's so riddled with conflicts of interest, no court of law would ever have allowed any of those commission members to sit on an independent tribunal. It was so riddled with conflicts of interest. Michael Kane, young 27-year-old activist, writer, hip-hop artist, he's wonderful, in New York, was there for me. He'd been writing for From the Wilderness for a while. He walks up to General Eberhardt after his testimony. What about the war game exercises? No comment. He asked two other generals. No comment. He goes to the Kane Commission chairman. Oh, we covered that somewhere in the staff report. Kane goes back to the generals and starts asking them, and they literally almost run out of the building. A 27-year-old guy with a ponytail who does hip-hop making four-star generals run out of the building. Many of my critics, they've actually been pretty quiet lately, such as David Korn of The Nation and others. Richard Clark spins a fantasy in his book, and it's one of the standard things which is used to hypnotize you. And basically what they say is, you could never keep an operation of this size secret because tens of thousands of people would have to know, and somebody would have talked. Nonsense. What you do is you have key people in key places know the critical parts. But clearly the U.S. has a long history of keeping secret operations secret. What about the Manhattan Project that gave us the atom bomb? Kept that pretty secret. A guy in the Tennessee Valley Authority refining uranium in 1943 would have no idea what it was going to be used for. They kept the F-117 stealth fighter a secret for a long time. A guy making epoxy resin out in Lancaster, Palmdale would have no idea that it was going to go on an airplane that couldn't be seen on radar screens. That's compartmentalization. But just as an example, and I bring up several people of interest in the book who are suspects, one of whom is Dave Frasca, supervisory special agent at the FBI, who stepped on five separate investigations, five, that could have brought many or all or some of the so-called 19 hijackers into custody before 9/11. One guy. Now, what happened to him? He was promoted right after 9/11. Congress did. How come you stepped on Colleen Rowley in Minnesota? How come you stepped on Ken Williams? How come you stepped on Robert Wright in Chicago? How come you? And then he gets promoted. There's an official at the State Department, Carl Rick Inderfirth, who protected the Taliban for many years before 9/11. The planning began under the Clinton administration. And it was essential that the 19 so-called hijackers be free and at large, otherwise their legend would not have been in place. That's an intelligence term. So that they could be where they were supposed to be on the day of 9/11. So, not necessary that you have 10,000 people, no. Not necessary that you have leaks. Okay, so this is just the basics of what I've outlined in Crossing the Rubicon. I make a case that I'll take to any judge. Well, not any judge. Sometimes judges are crooked. I make the case very clearly, but now let's go back and talk about the motive, because this also is more confirming behavior that shows that the working hypothesis, which is what detectives work with when they investigate cases. What you're looking at now on the screen is a very simple chart, line graph of world population. And you see that roughly from the time of the death of Christ to roughly 1800 or so was fairly stable. That little dip there in the 1400s is the bubonic plague. It starts to turn up when we invent the steam engine. Then we invent coal. That's the next upturn. But then the discovery of oil. And look at world population since the discovery of oil. Another way of saying that from an ecological standpoint, and there's much more data to support this, is that planet Earth's carrying capacity, absent oil, is about 2 billion people. I have a dear friend, Professor Richard Heinberg, PhD, a wonderful colleague. He's written two books, The Party's Over and Power Down, who is an ecologist. There's lots of other supporting information on this. Did you know, by the way, that there are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food you eat? How can that be, you say? Well, okay, let's figure it out. When you're a farmer, especially if you're agribusiness, what do you drive? You drive an oil-powered machine to plow the land. Then you drive an oil-powered machine to plant the seeds. Now you have to irrigate it. How do you pump the water? Electricity. How's the electricity generated? Oil or natural gas or coal. Then you got to fertilize it. What are all commercial fertilizers made from? Natural gas. All ammonia comes from natural gas. All commercial fertilizers are made from ammonia. Then you got to spray it with pesticides so those nasty old bugs don't eat it. What are all commercial pesticides made from? Oil. Then you got to harvest it. So you drive another oil-powered vehicle to harvest it. Then you got to drive it to a food processing plant. another oil-powered vehicle. Then you got to use electricity to process it. Then you add some chemicals, some of which have oil. Then you wrap it in plastic. All plastic is made from oil. Then you drive it by an oil-powered vehicle to a supermarket where you drive an oil-powered vehicle to go buy it and pay for it with a piece of plastic, which is oil that you take out of your wallet. Then you take it home and put it on a plastic plate, throw it in a microwave that works on energy, and you eat it. 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy for every calorie of food on the planet. Take away the hydrocarbon energy, what happens to the food?
More confirming evidence. Remember I showed you that triangle of where all the oil was? 60% of all the oil on the planet was in that area around the Persian Gulf. Now, this is U.S. This map is 2 years old. That's U.S. troop deployment. That's a two-year-old map that I drew. What have we surrounded? 60% of all the recoverable oil on the planet. Duh, that's another clue. You know? Not only that, I will tell you, and it's on the FTW website, that we're going to balkanize Iraq exactly the same way we balkanized the Balkans. Why? We don't need to run the whole country of Iraq. We only need the damn oil. If I go back to that first map at the beginning, you'll see that almost all the oil in Saudi Arabia is in a very tiny sliver of the country. So we balkanized Saudi Arabia. The Democrats have been good at vilifying Saudi Arabia, and I'm afraid Michael Moore helped with that. I think he bought into some of that stuff, and he shouldn't have. So now we will balkanize Saudi Arabia when the kingdom totters and King Fahd dies, and we'll create the United Arab Emirates of Aramco in Saudi Arabia. Our troops are already there to protect it. We don't need to protect the whole region. All we want, all we ever wanted, was the oil. Now, let's talk a bit about oil. Dick Cheney knows this. Oil companies know it. All oil production, whether it is in a single country or an oil field in West Texas or on planet Earth as a whole, always, always, always follows a bell curve. Axiomatic. Given that once a field, a country, or a planet reaches its peak of production, no matter how much money you throw at it, no matter how much technology you throw at it, you will never, ever, ever be able to increase production beyond that point again. Economists simply argue that by throwing money at a problem, you can solve it. The logic of that is by saying that if I lock you up in a bank vault with an unlimited amount of money, you can produce a ham sandwich. You cannot. The Earth is a closed sphere. Period. It is a closed system. Oil is not infinite. There's one funny rule about oil, that you have to discover it before you can pump it. Does that make sense? You got to find it before you can actually put it in somebody's gas tank. Global oil production peaked in 1962. We're now using 4 barrels of oil for every barrel that we find.
And the discovery.
Discovery. What did I say? Production. Oh, I'm sorry. The guy who came up with all these theories was a great, a wonderful geologist by the name of M. King Hubbard, who was going to go down in history as a prophet. In 1953, he was working for Shell, and he came up with this crazy concept that American oil discoveries peaked in 1930, and he said that production would peak some 40 years after discoveries. And guess what? U.S. oil production peaked in 1970-71. He was right, and they were calling him an idiot up until 1971. The CIA was on it, and I have seen, and I have even published some CIA reports that have been declassified showing that the CIA was well aware of peak and studying it. 40 years after peak of discovery, I got it right that time, peak of production. Peak of discovery was in 1962. What's 40 years after 1962? Now we get into some of the sociological, political, geo-heavy, Malthusian, nasty, weird stuff we don't want to think about. Stuff. When you superimpose, the red curve is hydrocarbon production. The green curve is global population. The black curve is hydrocarbon production per capita. And actually, believe it or not, on a planetary basis, hydrocarbon production per capita peaked in around 1980. That's a little bit off in this graph. We're already on a downslope. But what you see with the green line is something called population overshoot. Now, this is all inextricably woven together. You cannot have economic growth without burning more energy. Yet we live in an economic system. Our economic system in the United States is predicated on what? Fractional reserve banking, fiat currency, debt-based financing. In other words, we're living in an economic system which is a pyramid scheme. If Wall Street doesn't grow, it dies. It collapses. But you can't have economic growth is now colliding with finite energy. Vladimir Putin knows this. The world leaders know this because Vladimir Putin just endorsed Kyoto. And just yesterday, the Soviet Senate, by a vote of like 156-1, moved to ratify Kyoto. Vladimir Putin knows what he's saying. He's saying, if I endorse Kyoto, I'm saying an end to economic growth. Now, we live in a highly complex interrelated system. U.S. has factories in China. Japan has factories in China. Korea has factories in China. We're sending all our jobs over there, right? But guess what? China's having massive blackouts because they don't have enough energy. Massive blackouts all last summer. Shanghai, all through southern China, that were shutting down the GM plants, the Toyota plants, the Hyundai plants, the Microsoft plants, all the plants. Interrelationship. Serious interconnect. It's like that old game where you stack up the little blocks and everybody pulls out one, you know, and the last guy pulls one out and it all collapses. And an interesting analogy, two countries lost their oil when the Soviet Union collapsed in 91, North Korea and Cuba. North Korea remained a highly, tightly, top-down, hierarchically controlled, rigid economy. The North Korean people are starving to death. The whole system is falling apart. Why? You take a little natural gas to run the plant to make a couple of these things, then you cut the fertilizer production and the food crops diminish and people, I mean, it's horrible. Cuba, on the other hand, has completely decentralized. Cuba has inverted the top-down model, gone to completely local ownership, co-ops, place-based stock. It's like neighborhood stock corporations. My dear friend Catherine Austin Fitz, who wrote the foreword for the book, former Assistant Secretary of Housing. She knows a little bit about money. She was a managing director at Dillon Reed. Has said you got to flip the model, place-based financing. And in Cuba, total decentralization. Everybody grows their food locally. They own it locally. And Cuban food production is increasing. But they don't have to answer to a Wall Street that sells shares of stock that are dependent upon price-to-earnings ratio, return on investment, and that's the trap that we're in. So the way oil, you like that? Just for the record, I predicted last year's blackout, the big blackout, 6 weeks before it happened. How did I do that? Well, natural gas, we're in a worse pickle with natural gas than we are with oil. Oil, there will always be oil in the ground. We have picked, in terms of oil, all of the low-hanging fruit. We have found all the big fields. We have found all the light sweet crude. We have taken what was easy to get. That just follows logically from the way our economy works. But oil, when you start to pump it, you go into what's called secondary recovery, where you have to inject water. Saudi Arabia, you go to bottle brush, which is where you drill horizontally. You inject water. And you destroy the field. Gives you a little more time to a little more production for a little while. 55% in Ghawar, the largest field in the world, of what they pump out in Saudi Arabia today is the same water they pumped in that morning. Water injection. So gas just blows until there's no pressure and then it stops blowing. And we can't import natural gas. Why? Because we can only get it by pipelines. We need LNG for that, and that's really expensive. It's really dangerous. The whole country is NIMBY because natural LNG terminals blow up. One LNG tanker, we only need about 1,500, costs $150 million, takes 3 years to make. And you lose energy in the conversion process to gasification, regasification. But I predicted that, and people are going to freeze to death, mark my words, in this country this winter because there will be no heat to keep them warm. America gets 15% of its natural gas from Canada. What nobody tells you is that that's half of what Canada produces every year. Canada's running dry. Mexico's running dry. So what are we doing? We got 100 new coal-fired power plants under construction since 9/11, 100 plus. And they say it's clean coal. Now, there's a marketing ploy. I don't even have to go into that. Saudi Arabia possibly peaked in 2000. How many people saw this story in the National Geographic this summer? All right, let's do a little exercise. I'm at UCLA, so I don't have to belabor this point. You guys are all smart. Okay? You are. One little thing in here said that 7 gallons of oil, 7 gallons of oil in every automobile tire. Now, let's just fantasize for a moment. Let's say that some new technology presented itself, zero-point energy, right, which now makes it possible to not need oil to drive the 700 million internal combustion engines on the planet. But now we got to make 700 million new zero-point energy cars. Okay, 700 million times 4, leaving out the 18-wheelers, gee, what, that's 2.8 billion tires times 7 gallons of oil. That's all the oil you'd need just to make those new cars. You have to consider net energy, energy return on energy invested, before you really begin. Ethanol is a net waster of energy. It takes more energy to make ethanol than you get from burning it. Biomass is a good short-term solution, but until you calculate the energy that went into making the plant mass or the animal mass or whatever it is you're recycling to make diesel fuel, you realize that sustainability is an issue that is not easily solved. And this is how we all must start thinking about alternative energies. ABC News is now admitting peak oil. And these are just some of the headlines from the last year. It's beginning to penetrate public consciousness. National Geographic, BBC, Interpress News Agency, Pakistan, Moscow Times, Jane's Defense Weekly, Jane's and the Bible, Jane's Intelligence Weekly about peak oil, Foreign Policy in Focus, ABC News, the Sunday Times of London, The Economist, U.S. News, ad infinitum. 40, 50 stories. They're starting to come out now all the time. You haven't seen them saying, you know, we got a slight problem. But the problem is if they admit it, the markets crash. That's the problem they've always had to deal with. So now I see stories coming out the same day. Not enough oil, plenty of oil. Not enough oil, plenty of oil. It's the ultimate schizophrenia in the reporting. Is China the end game? Yes, 2 years ago I wrote a story saying that China was the end game. Now, I don't have a laser pointer, but if you know where the Straits of Malacca are, it's down by Singapore. I'll run over here. Straits of Malacca are down here. About 70% of all tanker traffic for Japan and China passes through the Straits of Malacca. China has just decided to build a pipeline through Burma to the Indian Ocean. Why? Because there's going to be a war in the South Pacific. We just sent seven aircraft carrier battle groups to conduct a war game exercise off the South China coast. If you look at this chart on oil consumption, the blue line is U.S. consumption. You see that little red line that's kind of curving up very sharply? That's Chinese oil consumption. What I got last week, I believe it's from the New York Times, is the increase in Chinese oil consumption between now and 2030 will equal the amount of oil consumed by the United States today. Whoa. Now, wait a minute. Oil discoveries peaked in 1962. Here's another clue. Last year in 2003, for the first time since the late 1920s, according to IHS, the world's leading petroleum investment firm, tracks everything, there was not a single discovery of a so-called mega field of oil. A mega field of oil is 500 million barrels. That sound like a lot of oil? Planet Earth uses 1 billion barrels of oil every 11 and one-half days. Last year, they didn't find a single field for a six-day supply for the planet. It takes 3 to 5 years to bring an oil field online. We know how many mega fields are already in development, and mathematically it is a certainty that by 2007 there is an absolute, unavoidable, overriding, horrendous gap between demand and production. Next year, you will see $100 a barrel oil next year. I'm bold in making predictions, but you know what? Those of you who followed my work for the last 7 years, you know I'm usually right. That's just because I have the map. Once you have the map, anybody can read the map. We're also going to be fighting in Saudi Arabia and West Africa.
West Africa. My God. We are going to destroy the African continent. Why? You know, just in the last 2 years alone, Gabon, Sao Tome, Principe, Equatorial Guinea, Nigeria, Angola, Chad, Cameroon, Sudan, which is not really West Africa, major guerrilla conflicts, China's moving in after the oil, India is moving in after the oil, major war game exercises in West Africa. There's not a ton of oil in West Africa. So why? It takes 6 weeks to get a drop of oil from the Persian Gulf into your gas tank. It takes 2 weeks to get a drop of oil from West Africa into your gas tank. It takes 4 days to get a drop of oil from Venezuela into your gas tank. You wonder why we want Venezuela so bad and why we're after Hugo Chavez so much? Viva Hugo Chavez! El Zorro, the fox. I clipped a headline recently from Reuters. And the headline was, Chavez calls Bush an asshole. That was the headline for the story. Basically, what he said was, how dare you come to me and tell me in my country that I need to have a referendum? I have won 6 elections in 4 years. How many has your president won? Okay? Then he said, if the United States tries another coup, I will shut off all Venezuelan oil supplies to the United States. 2 weeks later, a delegation from Beijing was in Venezuela negotiating to buy. Ooh. And next year, you're going to see strong moves to price oil in euros, which was Saddam Hussein's major crime. Some other headlines. China's rising grain prices could signal global food crisis. China's grain harvests have been falling for the last 5 consecutive years. In the United States, CNN Lou Dobbs even reported that, this was about a year ago, maybe less, that the only 2 countries ever to export grain, Canada and the U.S., will soon no longer be able to, which is nice because as the U.S. has been going out raping the world, colonializing, neo-colonializing, using either the Bush tactic or the neo-lib tactic, which is the IMF and the World Bank, same basic end result, we will no longer be able soon to export grain. Now, that was a kind of a little payback for the countries we were raping, but pretty soon we're not going to send them food. How long do you think that they're going to stand for that? Our soil, the single scariest story I have ever published in 6.5, almost 7 years of publishing From the Wilderness, probably 400 stories, is a story called Eating Fossil Fuels by Dale Allen Pfeiffer. And you read that story and you will never look at food the same again, and you will see how a complex system can implode with a lack of hydrocarbon energy. But our topsoil in this country is now little more than a sponge onto which we pour chemicals to grow food. This is a picture of the 7, describing the 7 aircraft carrier. Never before have we sent 7 aircraft carrier battle groups anywhere. And we had them in, and I can show you real quickly, where they went to the exercise. They went to the exercise right in the South China Sea, down near Hong Kong, up not far from the Gulf of Tonkin. That's the major tanker routes.
Can you elaborate what you said earlier on the war there?
Well, there is going to be a conflict there. China knows there's going to be a conflict there because why? The Philippines oil goes through there. Korea's oil goes through there. Japan's oil goes through there. China and Japan are today locked in an unbelievable battle that I've been following now for several years to see who will get one pipeline coming out of Siberia. The original proposal was to have it terminate in central China. The Russians kind of moved toward having it come out in the Sakhalin Islands on the Pacific coast, not far from Vladivostok, where they could sell wisely to the Japanese, the Koreans, the Philippines, the Indonesians. Indonesia is in total decline, by the way. Brunei, oil-rich country, is having an emergency meeting about how to meet its own energy needs. They're running out of oil. All these countries, 18 of the largest producers in the world, are in serious decline. I'll close with that. So we're going to collide over oil in West Africa. We've already got problems in Afghanistan. Here's a Navy exercise in West Africa. The Sunday Times Business, soaring oil prices leave China with an energy gap. U.S. struggles to encircle China. Here's something from the Voice of America. I love that. Everybody know what U.S. government agency the Voice of America is connected to?
CIA.
Okay. China's new African oil ties create concerns. No kidding. Military advisors, even Chinese. And Indians are moving into West Africa. Nigeria is about to explode. Actually, it has a couple of times. Clash of titans over West African oil. They aren't even talking about the U.S. They're talking about India and China in that story. Michael Clare, wonderful guy. He's a professor in New England. I've been at several conferences with him in Berlin and Paris on peak oil. He put it very succinctly when he analyzed the Cheney report. He says the amount of oil that the U.S. has to come up with in the next decade is equal to the amount of oil currently being consumed by India and China. But we aren't finding that oil, are we? China warns of more power cuts. You got to go, if you want to amuse yourself, go do some research on the blackouts in China. I have this great quote in a story we published recently about the G7. Well, I'm going to conclude with that. A great quote. Now, this is something scary. Natural gas futures up 21% in 1 week. What? Speculation is partly driving this, but that's not, speculation was a part of the California energy crisis. Enron didn't create the energy crisis. There was a shortage of natural gas. Enron and all the other companies just milked it for all it was worth and lied. Alan Greenspan finally admitting oil has sapped GDP growth. It's a mantra at the Council on Foreign Relations that oil price spikes inevitably lead to recession. Recession? You ain't even begun to see a recession yet when oil goes to 100. Just about 2 weeks ago, finally, the G7, the seven largest industrialized economies on the planet, admitted in a public statement, we don't have any idea how much oil there really is. Why? Because the books are cooked. Shell, among others, Shell had to downgrade its reserves four times last year. They were cooking their books. Why? Because the stock price is based upon stated reserves. Now, my critics will run up to me and say, wait a minute, I've looked at all these figures from ExxonMobil and all these other companies, and they show fields filling up with reserves. I'll tell you a secret. This is where those damn economists come into play again. Oil companies, if I'm an oil company and I find a field of 500 million barrels, I got to pay taxes on 500 million barrels the year I declare it. But if I declare 100 million barrels 1 year, I pay the taxes on that. I declare 100 million barrels. I amortize the cost of the tax burden. That has nothing to do with science or geology. And oil companies, if they make a big find 1 year, the stock goes way up. And if they don't make a big find next year, the stock price goes down. So they lie about their discoveries. It's all finance. It's all money. It has nothing to do with science. Nothing. And I got this great story from this great quote from Burma, where a Burmese official was talking to the Chinese government, and he told Reuters, China's need for oil is urgent, desperate, and great. So is ours. So is everybody else's. And here's where the system fails. Energy independence, both candidates are lying to you through their teeth. There is no such thing as energy independence. That's why I'm neither Democrat nor Republican. John Kerry's, what did John Kerry tell you? I'm going to increase the military by 200,000 men. Right. I'll fight the war on terror better than George Bush. Right. I'll make us independent of foreign oil. No, you won't. Hydrogen is a pipe dream. Hydrogen is a chimera. Absolutely. Arnold Schwarzenegger says, yeah, we have hydrogen highway. I'll pump you up. Yeah, sure. You know. Hey, hydrogen, one proton, one electron. It bleeds through metal. A University of California study, 1,113 gallons of gaseous hydrogen equals the energy of 1 gallon of gasoline. Electric Vehicle Magazine, 3 months ago, hydrogen fuel cell. The life expectancy of a hydrogen fuel cell engine is 200 hours. You want to buy a new engine every 200 hours of driving? There's no infrastructure to transport hydrogen. You know what they make hydrogen out of today? Natural gas. That's really wise. They got tar sands in Canada. You know how they get the oil out of the tar sands? They boil water with natural gas to make steam after they've raped the landscape to wash the oil, heavy oil, out of this. So they're using up all the natural gas to get a little bit of oil. In Alberta, they've actually begun debating building a nuclear reactor to make the steam. That's bright. I was at a peak oil conference in Berlin this year. I spoke with a French member of parliament, Yves Cochet, who is a member of the Green Party in the French parliament. So I was talking to him. He says, you know, in France, we are 75% nuclear, and we are going to build more nuclear reactors. There is a slight problem with this because every month, one truck leaves each reactor with plutonium. And all you have to do is hit one of those trucks with an RPG, and you kill 50,000 people. They are all dirty bombs driving around France. See, people don't think about these kinds of solutions. Cheney has thought about it. The neolibs, the neocons, the people who run the economy and this country, who are above both political parties, have thought about it. I don't have a plan for population reduction, but I'll guarantee you they do. Could you not picture Henry Kissinger sitting back and saying, well, the problem is not that there's too little oil. The problem is simply that there are too many people. Speaking of which, you mark my words on this. We broke some of the first stories on this about 8-10 months ago. My military affairs editor, Stan Goff, again, a man who I love, he writes so good. I have to smoke a cigarette after I read one of his stories. His writing is so good. And you should hear him when he gets pissed. He's wonderful. He's such a marvelous human being, and he was 20-plus years in U.S. Army Special Forces. He's done some nasty things, but this man has a conscience and a soul, and he has a love and a compassion. And he and I both know the draft is coming back next year, and you better get ready for it. I don't care what they say. You have 70,000 National Guard and reservists now being held on stop-loss orders, some for as much as a year and a half over their tours of duty. Their wives are leaving them. They've lost their jobs. AWOL rates are up for returnees. It's a sheer matter of mathematics. Now, we're going to be fighting probably in Saudi Arabia. They're talking about Iran, which is absolutely stupid. We can't militarily possibly invade Iran. But we got problems in West Africa. We got problems in Colombia. We got problems in Venezuela. China's moving militarily. Russia, India, everybody's moving. There's going to be a lot more conflict next year. And the math is very simple. We need some young, expendable fodder. And that's where I left this campus when I graduated in 1973. And that's why I don't want to come back to this campus looking at that possibility again. I don't want to see anybody here die for money in a foreign war. Now, things have changed a lot. When I was an undergrad here, you could go to Canada. Not anymore. They will stop you at the Canadian border under Homeland Security Act with great new computer systems. And once the draft is instituted, if your draft age, 18 to 30, or in the prime age, which is 22, they got smarter this time. They used to draft 18-year-olds, but mommy and daddy got involved. 22, you're 4 years out of the household, and mommy and daddy will interfere less. No student deferments. They'll stop you at the Canadian border if you're trying to leave, and if you get into Canada, they'll ship you right home immediately because the FBI now has offices in 48 countries around the world, and all Canadian border patrol and all Canadian law enforcement systems are integrated with ours under the Homeland Security Act and Patriot Act. I've started to compile a list of countries, what you see as a partial list for my subscribers, because this is very expensive work, of about 75 countries, asking whether or not they will extradite to the U.S. for draft evasion. And you can see there are some countries that won't. New Guinea, great, you can live with the headhunters. New Zealand, problem is you've got to get into New Zealand. You still have to get visas to get into these countries. Norway will not. Russia will not. Sweden will not. Switzerland will not. But again, how do you get there? You can be deported for being an illegal just as easily as for being a draft evader. But the FBI now has legal attachés in 48 countries, and there were only in about 13 to 14 countries during the Vietnam War, and the laws have changed completely. Because I'm going to have to wrap it up here. We do want to answer some questions. But what I want to say is I've tried to paint a picture for you tonight of what's in my book, Crossing the Rubicon. We have copies of the book outside, available for sale. You can buy them from our website, from thewilderness.com. And let me give you a little clue. I haven't survived in this game long enough without having learned how to fight the way the corporations fight. We've done some guerrilla marketing. So I would ask that you buy it from my website. We match Amazon's price. If you don't buy it from my website, buy it from Amazon. Why? Because that drives us up the Amazon bestseller list. We've been as high as 38 out of 500,000 titles. And that's the entree to the New York Times website. And our book has just started to hit. I am so grateful to UCLA. I feel this is home for me. And there's no way I can express the love I feel for this campus and this university, what it gave me and what it taught me. And I hope I've given you just a little bit back. Thank you very much.